Michael Meets is a podcast interviewing regular people about life, work, their interests and aspirations. Thanks to everyone who subscribed via iTunes. I entered the Irish iTunes podcast chart this week at a great number 43. I really appreciate all your support and I look forward to continuing to share the fantastic life stories of regular people. This week's podcast is also a very special one. When I started this podcast, I made a rule that I wouldn't interview friends or family. I just thought it would be really awkward. But two podcasts in, a number of friends and family members have asked, could they be interviewed? And after some thought, I just thought, why not? They've got great stories to tell as well. The rule is, though, that they can only be interviewed around special occasions. For example, my mother will be interviewed, I would guess, around Mother's Day. This week has been a historic week for Ireland in that we were the first country in the world to ask its citizens by public vote if they'd grant equal rights to the LGBT community by allowing same-sex marriage. It was a resounding yes by 62% of the electorate. So this week, you'll hear from my husband. When we declared our love for each other, our marriage ceremony wasn't legal, so I thought it fitting to interview him this week. And maybe again, if we do legally get married, because this time he just didn't shut up. I have to warn you though, that Jerse swears throughout the podcast. He talks about Santa, so if you have kids in the car, turn it off and listen later. I can't be held responsible for your kids being mentally scarred or for ruining their Christmas forevermore. The year was 1969, the year that the People's Democracy Civil Rights March left from Belfast to Derry. Samuel Beckett was awarded the Nobel Prize for Literature, and Sugar Sugar by the Archies was the top-selling song of that year. It was also the year that Gerard O'Donnell was born, in the city of Limerick.
Actually, I think I can remember being born.
Actually being born?
Yeah, I think I can remember being born. Or maybe it's that I was told so many stories about how I was born. I was born, first of all, I was born on the worst day that you could ever be born on. It's the 30th of December. So it's 2 days after St. Stephen's Day and 1 day before New Year's Eve. So as an adult growing up, no one really wanted to go out or celebrate your birthday. They'd always say, oh, I'll go out with you on New Year's Eve. Kind of thing. So I never really had very many birthdays celebrated because of my birthday. But I was a home birth, and basically what that meant was I was delivered in my home in 12 Assumpt Park. The day I was being born, all my brothers and sisters, who were 9 of them, were sent to the cinema while Dr. Murray came around to my mother's house and delivered me. Just as my mother started to get into heavy contractions, a blackout happened in our neighbourhood. So all the neighbours had to run around. They were all getting candles and stuff like that, and you know, to provide light, basically. So it was kind of a dramatic entrance into the world. I was born by candlelight.
And you can remember that? You think you can remember that?
I think I was told so many times about it when I was young that I might have dreamt it. Do you know what I mean? I think I might have dreamt it at a very early age, but I have a vision in my head of being held by my mother with candles all around us. But like, my sisters and brothers always said, like, oh, there was something evil coming into the world. You know what I mean? All the lights in our estate went out. All the street lights, all the house lights, all went out. Growing up in a house with 5 brothers and 4 sisters was... oh my God, what, I can't, there is the words to explain it are, it was literally like, I think the word is tumultuous. It was like 1 minute, it was like you were really happy, everything was going great, and the next minute it was just chaos. It was just always mixed feelings, like you were crying at one part of the day, you were, you know, laughing at another part of the day. There were so many people in our house, and so there was so much life in our house. Not only that, but there was always other kids in our house as well as, you know, my 5 brothers and sisters. It was mental, but the great thing about it was the access to music that I had through them, because they all had different tastes in music, and so I got to kind of pick and choose what kind of music, you know, I liked. So I had a vast knowledge of music at a very young age. We had three bedrooms. My mother and father would be in the box room, which would be like a tiny room. And then there was 2 other small rooms, but we thought they were massive. and there would be the boys in one room, which would be 5 boys in one room and 4 girls in the other room. But as a kid, I always wanted to sleep in with my sisters. I hated being in with my brothers because my sisters would let me draw pictures and my brothers were always kind of, I don't know, there was always something grim about my brother's room. And I even remember at a very young age, my father, when I was about 4 or 5, coming in and dragging me into my brother's room, you know, telling me, sleep in there, you're a boy, you should be in with the boys. And I just remember feeling like, oh, this was the worst. I remember that was one of the most traumatic experiences of my life when I was a child, being taken away from my sisters and put into my brother's room. It was so horrible.
Yeah.
The difference in the rooms, where the atmosphere was so different. And I noticed that as a child. An average day would kind of be kind of getting beat up by one of my brothers, but then having great fun with another one of my brothers, or having great fun with my sisters or something. You know, it was always like that, or getting beaten up by my father or screamed at by my father. And you know, when you're a child, you take those things so seriously and you're like, oh, this is really hurting me. One of the most embarrassing moments of my life was my brother had bet me. We used to always bet each other 5 pence, right, when we were kids. It was always a 5p bet because that was the money we had access to. But I loved 5 pence. I didn't even love 10 pence. I loved 5 pence because I could get a lucky bag of ice pop and a bag of potatoes for it. So when we were kids, he said to me, after my niece was born, he said, I bet you can't get into Lisa's strawberry shortcake dress. And I was like, I bet you I can. And he was like, OK, I bet you 5 pence. So I wriggled and squished myself into this. I was 11, like, you know what I mean? A kind of skinny enough kid, like. But I managed to get myself into this 1-year-old's dress. Well, actually, she wouldn't have even been one until she was about 6 months old. It was like a little strawberry shortcake dress, you know. And the bottom of the dress literally came to my ribcage. So it was really tight and I couldn't breathe. So and he said, yeah, but now we have to zip it up. So they managed to zip up this dress on me. And then when I was in the dress, it was like a straitjacket. And I was just standing up in the room going, where's my 5 pence? And then he called all my brothers and sisters upstairs and said, look, I caught you trying on Lisa's little dress. Oh my God, my brother Patrick used to always torture me and play loads of games with us when we were kids. Once he said to us, he had a pellet gun. Like, a pellet gun really hurts when you're in like a small room and you're getting shot at like point blank distance. But he gave me 2 pieces of board and he said, you deflect the bullets like Wonder Woman. And he just literally fought. It was like literally shooting fish in a barrel. Doesn't even come close to it. Like, he literally just followed me around the room, shoot me, and I was trying to deflect these pellets with 2 little pieces of cardboard, supposed to be my Wonder Woman wristbands. I had a few best friends on the street. I had Brian Dillon, Gerard Mack, and Richard Nolan then in later years. We were just normal kids, you know, growing up, playing around and stuff like that. When my father died, Brian Dillon called over to my house and he said to me, Ger, he said to my husband, Michael, he said, you know, Jared was a real, it was an honor or something like that. Or it was a real pleasure to know Jared as a child growing up. He said, because he had such an imagination. And I asked Brian, I was like, why had I such an imagination? And one of the stories he told me was that we used to play by a riverbank. There's a riverbank near our house. We used to play by the riverbank and I came up to Brian with a bottle and a message inside it from a Peruvian princess. And this letter read, oh, I'm trapped in this kingdom, la da 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 da, this big spiel. And so my friend Brian, anyway, I took the note out of the bottle and showed it to him. And then he said to me, he said, oh, where is it from? Peru, is it? And then he looked at the bottle. He goes, how come the bottle has Shannon Minerals written on it? And it was one of those things I went, oh God, I really should pay much more attention to detail. So I loved frightening the shit out of people when I was young. And I'd always come up with these like elaborate plans to scare people, you know. One of them involved myself and Brian Dillon going out the bank. There was a river bank at the back of our house. And there was trees lined up along it. And the housing estates, you could see the trees and the bank from the housing estate. And my elaborate plan was that we'd get dressed up in these white sheets and kind of like put them on like robes and wear all black clothes. And we'd go from one tree to the next tree in white. And then when we got behind the tree, we'd shove the white garb up our jumpers because we were dressed all in black. And then we'd crawl along the ground to the next tree. And then we'd appear between the next tree and the tree beyond that. So it looked like to the kids on the street that there were ghosts just appearing between the trees. It was like, it was special effects at its like cheapest and best when we were kids. And the kids started freaking out, really screaming and getting frightened. And of course, I got the biggest kick out of this because, you know, my plan was working and stuff. But Brian Dillon was like, he was a really good, we were good kids, you know, but he was like, he was an extra good kid. And his mother would never allow him to run beyond the bank. When the kids started freaking out, all these mothers came out and go, what's going on in the street? You know, we really terrified him. It was brilliant. And all these mothers came out and obviously they knew it was two other kids messing, you know, so they came out the riverbank. You know, there was no way for us to go off the riverbank, only we had to run really fast and run past them. So we were legging it anyway, you know what I mean? Like tearing down the bank to get passed out of our estate, right? And the mothers were kind of coming at us from like one angle, and the other angle, the only option was to jump into a river, to jump into the nettles, or just run out of our estate and, you know, back around into the top of our own estate. But Brian Dillon was such a good child, like, that he was like, as we were running, he was going, no, my mother doesn't allow me to run past, you know, run past this, the end of the estate. And I was like, we're going to get fucking killed, like, you know, by all these other mothers from the next estate. And so what did he do? He jumped into a big pile of nettles and hid in the nettles. And then all the mothers came up and beat him up. And I just ran away and I got away with it all. Myself and my brother, Martin, we were always put up to bed really early. Well, we were put up to bed at like 9 o'clock, and the new Avengers, this TV series, used to be on in the 70s, and it was like our lives. It used to just revolve. Everything was like about the new Avengers. I used to be drawing pictures of them, and you know, so the new Avengers would be coming on at 9 o'clock, and myself and Martin would like literally sit on the landing of our house and just kind of scream and cry to get downstairs, like please, like begging and begging and begging. But so one night we decided, I said, look, this is it now, right? You know, we've been begging long enough. So I put this really great elaborate plan together where we stuffed some of Martin's clothes with all our other clothes and kind of joined them together, tied them together. So it looked really like, I really made it look like a body, you know what I mean? And he had kind of ginger hair and we had this orange teddy bear. So we stuck the teddy bear in the top so it looked a bit like ginger hair, but luckily we had a hoodie, you know, and I had it all worked out in my head, you know. So all my brothers and sisters were all sitting down watching the new Avengers while we were upstairs crying to come down and watch the new Avengers, which I could never understand, because it would have been easier for them to just let us down and we'd be quiet and watch it and then we go to bed, instead of us screaming and crying the whole way through it, interrupting them watching it, you know. So it didn't, like, as a child that didn't make sense to me. So anyway, so one night we shouted down, we were going like, that's it, Martin's going to kill himself if we don't get down to see the new Avengers. Of course, it was Martin killing himself, not me. So we, our TV was kind of like, it's kind of in the corner, but it's over by the window, you know, and our bedroom was above the TV room. So I was like, all right, that's it, he's going to kill himself, right? And they were all taking absolutely no notice downstairs, and we were like, this is it, he's going to kill himself, right? So we got our like little fake body full of clothes, our little stuffed like human body full of clothes, and we tossed it out the window, and I got Martin to scream as it went past the downstairs window, and they took absolutely no notice of it once. I don't even know if they saw it, like, but I was like screaming, like knocking on the living room door going, Martin just killed himself. Look out the window. Martin's just after killing himself because we didn't get to see the new Avengers. It's all your fault. He's commit suicide. And oh God, we were so stupid. As I said, like, I was really into frightening people. Like, and I mean, I wanted to terrify the shit out of people. I was obsessed with horror films. I saw The Exorcist when I was 11. Chrissy Houlihan brought me into her house and she showed me the full unedited Exorcist, the cross and everything, you know what I mean? I was obsessed. That was it. I was like, oh my God, I wanted to be the Exorcist. I thought, oh my God, this is the best thing ever. you know, I kind of had a look at the make, you know, the look at her makeup and looked at how disturbing and crumpled up she was and everything. I decided one night, like in our estate, it was really, really quiet after, like, you know, 7 o'clock on a winter's night. It was really, really dark out. And like past 9 o'clock, there wouldn't be a soul on the street. And I said, I know what I'll do. So I got like really white and black, like just on my sister's makeup and stuff like that, or whatever was lying around the house, like, and blackened in all my eyes and put all, like, you know, lipstick, like blood on my face. But it looked like, I looked in the mirror and was like, this is convincing, like, this is disturbing, you know. I went up to the top of our street, and the top of our street was Mac's house, which had a really high wall. So there was this woman coming down, and I was just hiding behind this wall with, like, a white sheet wrapped around my head, and this, like, my face all done up with this horrible makeup. It's been about 11 or 12, like, at the time. And I was waiting just for anyone to pass, but it just so happened I could hear the footsteps of someone coming, but I couldn't see them because it was, like, pitch blackout. And I heard them getting closer and closer, and then I heard them, you know, really within my earshot. So I jumped up and went, "Aah!" You know, like this. And next thing I looked, and it was this really old woman, and she started kind of like that, and she held onto the wall, and she like acted like dizzy. And I thought it was after, I looked at her and thought, oh my God, I'm after giving this woman a heart attack, like I'm responsible for her death. So I took off my thing and legged it down and ran down the back of our, because we had fields at the back of our house, and like rubbed it out. And actually, do you know what, I never went up to see, obviously she was all right, because there wasn't a dead body found on the ground or anything like that. There was a woman who lived in our estate, and she had a birthmark on her eye, and it looked like a piece of brawn. Now, brawn was like a meat that you could get in the 70s. I don't even know if you could get it now, but like anyone that grew up in the 70s would understand what brawn was. So I had this amplifier my friend Richard Nolan gave me, Teat Nolan we used to call him because he had a gap between his teeth, and I had the amplifier up on my windowsill, and I had a microphone going into it, and it again, it was really dark. It was like a winter's night, like 10 o'clock, 11 o'clock at night. And I saw this woman coming down the avenue, and I had the microphone and I had it set to reverb. And she was coming in the street, and I was going, brawny eye, I can see you, I can see you. Like trying to scare her. And next thing she looked up and she goes, Gerard O'Donnell, I can see the light on in your window. Because I forgot that the amplifier had a red light on it, the on switch, and I had the amplifier phased out the window, so I totally nabbed about that. I think about Limerick people is, like, it's almost like if you have a fault, that would be your nickname, you know? There, like, in our estate, there was, like, we were called I was called Sausages or Steamer or, well, not faggot, because that word wasn't really around, but, you know, like, they'd call me, like, some of the kids would call me a gay boy and stuff like that when I was younger, but, like, Sausages, because there was McDonald's Sausages and our name was O'Donnell. But then there were some kids that had, like, you know, severe deformities. Like, there was this guy who was living in the next estate over from us, and he had, like, an abnormally large head, and it was deformed. Like, it was, like, at the back of his head was really deformed, and he was a little bit slow. But, like, what was his nickname? Pregnant Skull. You know, there was absolutely no mercy shown at all. And that's what he responded to. It was like, hi, Pregnant Skull, come here and I blah, blah, you know, tell you this, whatever. And that was what they did. And there was another guy called, he was full of, basically, pimples, and his skin was full of blackheads, there was lumps all over it. And he was full of carabuncles. So his name was, I don't actually know what these guys' real names ever were, but his name was Uncle Bunkle. And people, he responded to that, like that was his name, but like in the, you know, it was mad. You just wouldn't, it was so politically incorrect, like you'd never get away with it now, you know, but in those days it was just accepted. Once you face those kind of things, you know, as a child and stuff, I think you kind of grow up a lot stronger, because it's like, what worse could be said to you? Your most obvious physical fault is your nickname. On our street there was a guy, Richard Nolan, we used to call him Teeth because he had a split between his teeth. So he's obviously going to be called Teeth. And then there was another kid across the road, his name was Gummy Peters, because apparently he didn't get his teeth until he was like 6 years old. And it was just, yeah, that was the way it was.
What was school like?
from the minute I set foot in school, I hated school. I knew I was never going to like it. I was never going to be good at it. And you know what? I didn't want to be. It was as simple as that. School is one of those things that I could have done without in my life. I would have learned to read and write somewhere else. I still can't do math. Do you know what I mean? School was a nightmare. The minute I went in there, I felt... It was the first time I went, I felt so different to everybody else and felt so alone. And I couldn't have been more surrounded by people. It was the most... Number one, I remember my first day at school. It was a fucking nightmare. I remember my mother bringing me up and telling me that Brian Dillon, your best friend, is going to be there and this, that. And I was like, okay, that's all right. And I remember my nerves coming at me. And I remember her bringing me into Sister Rosario's class. Sister Rosario was this big, fat, ugly, cruel bitch. Everybody hated her. The minute I looked at her, I hated her. I formed opinions so quickly when I was young about people. I just knew who to stay away from and who I would gravitate towards. But I remember my mother telling me Brian Dillon was going to be there. And that was my crutch. I was like, okay, Brian is going to be there. And Brian Dillon wasn't there. And that was just, I looked around the class and I was going like, where's Brian Dillon? There was all these other kids I didn't know. And I remember bawling and squealing. And I remember my mother kind of basically pushing me in the door. And Sister Rosario making me, just screaming at me to sit down. And just the look she gave me, I just sat down so quiet. And then I was just, and from that day forward, school was a fucking nightmare. School was a nightmare until I met Donna Farrell when I was 11. And then school was fun because school wasn't school anymore. You know, school was someplace. I have found somebody in my life that I really could communicate with and had the same warped sense of humour as me, you know. Like, all my report cards used to say, oh, Jared is really intelligent, but he doesn't employ himself. But they didn't know that I was dyslexic. You know, I was trying to do these things, but it just wasn't working out for me for some reason, you know. But what I did love was myself and Dan O'Farrell used to give each other funny homework. So we'd have to go home and we'd have to write a story or make up a song and stuff. And for that year of school, it would have been 1980 or 1979. I was either 9 or 10. Our funny homework became such a priority and such a part of our lives that we used to sidestep our other homework and we used to get into such trouble over it, you know. That was good. I felt that was when I started to enjoy school, really, when I was about 11. But that only lasted for that year. Gotten into David Bowie when I was about 9. So I was looking at images of Ziggy Stardust when I was like 10 years of age. And music was so strong in my, like, music was so strong in my personality growing up. Music and art was all I ever wanted. And so, you know, I started wearing eyeliner and stuff like that at the age of like 13. So at 12 and stuff, I started to dress a little bit different. I just knew that I wanted to be different. And I wanted the attention of being different as well. I just wanted to single myself out because up until that point, I think as a child, I always tried to be normal. I always felt myself like I was on the outside looking at all these people and going, you're all not really like me, you know, in this sense. It was just the kids in the neighborhood, the things they wanted to do. They weren't things that I really wanted to do, you know. I developed OCD when I was about 6. I didn't want to go out playing. I didn't want to dirty my clothes. I just wanted to sit on the step at my front door drawing pictures all day long. And I remember someone asked me, why don't you go out playing with the other kids? And I said to them, I don't really want to get my clothes dirty, because they were lovely and clean. So that was kind of, I was an odd child. This is the weird thing about me. When I was a child, when I look back, I thought I was a normal child. I was not a normal child by any stretch of the imagination. For one, I never ever believed in Santa Claus. I don't know why, I just knew it was a lie. Instinctually, I knew that what they were telling me was bullshit. I didn't believe it. But what I did think was, I thought that everybody believed the same thing as me, but wouldn't say it. you know, my thoughts alone in bed at night. I had a lot of them as a kid and I remember them. And I always remember going, yeah, everybody thinks exactly the same as me, but no one's saying it. You know, it's kind of something that spilled over into my adult life as well, actually. But I didn't believe in Santa Claus, but I believed that I had the power to make things like a carpet fly. I was obsessed with magic carpets when I was a kid and obsessed with things like tornadoes and whirlpools. I think everybody goes through those little phases when they're kids. Their kind of imagination just locks onto something and starts to run with it. When we were kids and we got our first carpet, because when we were kids, it was all lino in the house because the lino was cheap. And I remember we got our very first carpet. When you get the new carpet, there's always a remnant, it's called, just a bit of the carpet left over. And my mother used to put them at the start of the, you know, in the hallway, just to wipe your feet on or something. But I truly believed that that with the power of my mind and my friend's mind, Gabriel Peters and Sam Meaney, I truly believed that we could have made that carpet fly because I believed in magic carpets. I believed in myself and the things I could do with my mind, but like, I didn't believe in anything else. I never believed in Santa Claus. I stopped believing in religion, I'd say, when I was about 11. Not because religion had so many unanswered questions, but basically, it was anytime I asked a question in religion class, this was when I was like, when I started in first year, when I was about 11, I was always thrown out of the class, constantly sent down to the principal's office for being disruptive. But I was only asking questions like, I couldn't understand the physics of Moses parting the seas, for instance. I didn't accept it. I just didn't accept that he parted the seas. I wanted an explanation, a physical explanation as to how that happened. And the teacher just thought I was like, and it was loads of miracle questions and things, loads of questions about the Bible. I always asked questions. And it wasn't that I just didn't believe in it. I just couldn't believe in it. The frustration that the priest who was our teacher, because we used to have priests as teachers, it was the frustration in him because he couldn't answer it made me not believe it more, if you know what I mean.
And what did the teacher say to you when you were like, apart from just sending you down to the principal's office? Like?
Basically, I would go, but sir, how did Moses part the sea with his staff, you know? And I would say, like, would it be? And I'd try and go into, like, could it have been, you know, like this? Or I'd be just trying to come up with these stupid, you know, reasons as to why. Because in a sense, I think I wanted to believe it because I wanted to fit in with everyone else. But he would just say things like, he was saying, it was a miracle. It was a miracle. And I'd say, yeah, but how did it happen? And he'd say, the sea, because this is the one that I remember the most. And he said, the sea's just parted. And I'd say, but how did they part? And he said, it was a miracle. So it was like that thing. And I was going, but I don't understand. And then eventually he would just get so frustrated and say, I was holding up the class and send me down to the principal's office. And I'd go down to the principal's office and the principal, his name was O'Connell. Daniel O'Connell was his name. I think the same name as the like famous Limerick man. But he was Headmaster O'Connell, I think his name was. And one day he said, well, I wasn't an ideal student in secondary school either. You know, I was always getting into trouble. I wasn't a troublemaker. I was just always caught doing really stupid things. And I was always caught. That was it. That was the thing. I wasn't the worst pupil in the school. I was always caught. But I was thrown out of school, basically, when I was 13. So I think he was just sick of looking at my face in the office, really. And yeah, basically, I got expelled. And my mother couldn't believe that I got expelled because I was such a good kid, really. You know, I was never any trouble to anyone. You know, I was just like, I was me, my art, my music. That was it. I was happy out, apart from when I used to get the odd baiting off my brother or my father or whatever. But apart from that, I was happy out with myself as a child, you know. And then all of a sudden, my mother was like looking at me and I came home and I was like, I was expelled from school. And she was like, oh my God, she couldn't believe it. She marched me back up the road to the school, back up to the headmaster, Mr. O'Connell, and begged him to take. And he said, Mrs. O'Donnell, honest to God, I wouldn't have him here if you paid me. I remember those words coming out of his mouth so clear. And my mother begging him, please take him back. He'd give him a second chance and this, that and the other. And he said, he's been in the office more times than anybody of the last 2 years. I was actually in the office more times. I wasn't the most disruptive student because there were sneaky little fuckers around, but I was always being caught doing stupid things, you know.
And were you your mother's favourite?
I was definitely my mother's favourite, without a shadow of a doubt. There was no question about it. I talked to my mother like she was a human being when I was a kid. And I remember always having that feeling that I was minding my mother as well, you know. Even though she was minding me, I always had that thing. We were very close to each other. You see, the rest of my family don't realise this, but me and my mother were so similar in so many ways. I would talk to my mother about things that I know she didn't have conversations about my others, you know, have those conversations with my other brothers and sisters. Like, they were, and it wasn't even like they were like top secret or she was telling me anything that she didn't. I think it was the questions that I was asking her. She always answered my questions and she always gave me reasons and explanations for stuff.
But how do you know you were the favourite? I'm sure, like, if I spoke to one of your other brothers or sisters, they might
No, they wouldn't. They'd all agree. I think all of my family would agree that I was the favourite of my mother. It was obvious. It was just obvious. It was just one of those obvious things. I was always the cutest, definitely, without a shadow of a doubt. And it's so much easier to love a cute kid than an ugly one, you know. I think my younger brother Martin was way cuter than me. But he had kind of red hair and freckles, and that was a normal thing. Whereas I had black hair. I had dark brown hair and green eyes and like sallow skin. And I was a very pretty kind of child, you know. And I even remember looking back at my school photos and I'd say, oh my God, I was the only good looking kid in the class. They were all hideous. Like, I looked back at an old school photo someone put up on Facebook and I thought, oh my God, what a bunch of munters. Like, they were actually, when I looked at their faces, it was comical because I was kind of going, you know, because you don't see your own face as a child, do you? You know, you don't spend, even though I was kind of, I do remember being vain because all my brothers, all my older brothers' girlfriends would always go, oh, he's gorgeous, oh, he's beautiful, he's like a little Spanish child and all this stuff. I remember that being said to me and I remember being, oh, I must be really, you know, cute and good looking and stuff and, you know, I can get away with things because of this. And still am, thanks. I think it wasn't just that. I just think I spent so much time with my mother and I was so devoted to her. It was just one of those things. It was like the umbilical cord was never cut. How can you explain love like that? How can you explain why you love somebody or why they love you so much? I can't explain how much me and my mother loved each other, but it's, anyone will tell you that I was obviously her favourite. But then you see, my father hated my fucking guts, you know, and we did not get on at all. We were just completely opposite, separate people. We did not like each other as human beings, you know. It had nothing to do with me being gay. It had nothing to do with like the choices I made in my life. I'm talking about from when I was a kid. I felt that my father was put on this earth to actually torture me physically and mentally. And on the other hand, I had all this love for my mother. You know, you should never feel too loved like that because it spoils you. But you should never feel hated by anybody, you know. So once me and my brother were having an argument about a jacket out in the backyard at lunch break during school. My mother was in England at the time and we were just having like a normal kids argument. But as I was going back into the house, back into the kitchen, my father was standing in the kitchen and he hit me a full force dig in the chest and sent me flying backwards back out the back door, you know. And I went to save myself, you know, just put my hand back to try and land somewhere, but I ended up putting my hand on the really sharp edge of this old twin tub washing machine that was just sitting out in the backyard, and it slit my hand and literally the blood was like squirting out of my hand, like pumping blood. It was, and I, you know, I was terrified. I was crying because after getting a dig in the chest, like, and I was looking at the blood, so I was terrified as well. And next thing, I was kind of like in the kitchen. I remember kind of like more or less my family were kind of ignoring it, really. Do you know what I mean? There was like a good few people in the house. It was lunchtime. There was like, you know, a couple of kids in our house older than me, and everyone seemed to kind of ignore it. And then I just remember my father coming back down the stairs with a piece of ripped sheet, wrapped it around my hand, sent me back to school. Then one of the teachers had to get the remedial teacher, Mrs. Smith, to bring me to the hospital to get it like bandaged up properly, or, you know, see if I need stitches or anything. And he was just a cruel fucking cunt, really, if I'm being honest about it.
And did that get better as you got older?
I would never say that our relationship got better. I'd say it got easier because I left. My mother always kind of sent me out, you know, to my sister's house to live or to my sister's house to babysit, anything to get me out of the house so me and my father wouldn't be arguing. Now, when I say me and my father arguing, I literally would walk in the door and my father would just start on me for no reason whatsoever. It was like he was waiting for me to come in the door so he could find a reason to give out to me or scream at me or shout at me, just to really make me feel like shit. As I got older, I understood who he was. And I understood that there was a bitterness there. And I know that deep down inside, my father feels he didn't fulfill his potential. And I think there was a bit of jealousy there regarding, not that I'd fulfilled my potential, but that I was always in the papers for being in bands and stuff like that. And I was always kind of like, you know, even if it was like winning little art competitions, I never remember him saying, well done, when I would do any of those things, never. And I think that's just kind of nasty, if I'm being honest. But then I'd hear that he would be in the pub talking to my friend's father going, oh, Gerard did this and Gerard did that. And I'm kind of going like, but why not just say that to me? You know, why go up and brag about me who you torture, you know, in a pub to somebody else? That's even worse, I think, than not saying it at all. As I got older, our relationship got a bit easier. He loved my husband, Michael. He really liked Michael. And he liked all of my friends. My father liked all of my friends. And they all thought he was a lovely man. Great man. Oh my God, he's such a great fella. Sitting down, he'd talk to them, that's the other, you know. I'd never have a problem bringing anybody into my house and introducing them to my father, because he would talk to them, you know, and he would make them feel at home. He'd probably bore them to death. What was I like as a teenager? Oh my God, I was the most fabulous person that ever lived. I had such a high opinion of myself as a teenager. Number one, I was practically a drag queen. I started wearing makeup when I was 13, right? I started dressing and acting like I was literally a famous pop star when I was 14. Oh my God, I was a joke. To see me coming down the street, it was literally, you know, one side of my head would be shaved. Then I'd have like, you know, the other side would be all back coming up. Full face of like, you know, makeup, punk makeup, but well done makeup. Always really well done. My mother used to borrow makeup from me when I was like 14. It was so normal for her to come into my room, and I would have two dressing tables actually full of makeup, because Richard Nolan, my best friend, his girlfriend, owned a chemist. Well, their family owned a chemist, and she used to give us all the surplus makeup stock. And of course, he used to give it all to me. We used to divide it up between us. So we had like literally every brand, Max Factor, all brilliant makeup. And we used to literally just sit there painting on our faces. We used to, as a teenager, I was wild. Oh my God. I started drinking at 13 and 14, the end of 13 and 14. Started robbing flagons of cider from Dunn's stores, right? Sorry, Dunn's, but you were so easy to rob from back in the day. We used to rob, myself and Connor Byrne. Connor Byrne showed me how to rob earrings, right? And then he showed me how to rob books from one shop and sell them to another shop. So what we would do is we'd go in, we'd rob some school books from O'Mahony's bookshop in Limerick. Shit. And what we do is we'd crinkle all the books up and then write names on the insides of them and then go up to the second-hand bookstore and sell them, because you got a lot of money for like school books when you were a kid, you know. So we'd make them look a bit old and then we'd go up and we'd sell the second ones. Then what we'd do with the money is go down to Dunn's and either buy drink. In those days, we didn't even bush drink though. We used to just go down the laneway of this bar called Buddy's, and literally we had so much makeup on. And our hair was standing so high and our clothes were so outrageous that you couldn't tell whether we were boys or girls or what age we were. We used to walk into discos and We used to get in on, we used to go into discos on ladies' nights and get in for free because we used to have that much makeup on. It was brilliant time. It was, oh my God, I would never trade. My teenage years were some of the best years of my life. They were amazing. It was just a constant adventure, 4 days a week. And I don't condone this in any way because I don't even drink myself now. But 4 days a week, we were drunk. And I'm talking about hammered, drinking flagons of cider, bottles of wine, and ending up in flats, ending up in all sorts of scenarios. I remember when I was 16, I witnessed an orgy. I wasn't involved in it, but I actually witnessed an orgy happening in this person's flat in Limerick. It was so, like, the 80s was, there was one club in town. There was two bars, the Pink Elephant and Buddies. And they were two kind of alternative bars. And basically, my teenage years were spent between those two bars, getting as splattered as I possibly could.
Did you leave home young?
Yeah, it was 1990. I went and left home for good then in 1990. I went to live in London. That was amazing for about 4 or 5 weeks. I stayed there for 4 or 5 years. But the first couple of months were amazing, you know. Bright lights, thought we were all going to be famous, busking on the streets, you know, all young and beautiful. Myself and Siobhan Gallagher went over and, you know, we just thought, oh, this is it. Now we're made, like, we're after getting to London. This is it. Like, how couldn't we be, you know, successful? Like, you know what I mean? Oh my God. We were planning to be, like, successful. We were planning to be in a successful band. But that went downhill really fast. We busked, though. We busked and we always got loads of money busking, which was great. I loved that. I loved going busking in London in the tube station. Because we were kind of like Goths, and but Goths didn't really busk. You know, you'd never see, like, you know, two young, you know, we were two lovely looking kids. You know what I mean? I know we were, and people used to kind of say, oh my God, you know, what a lovely looking young couple the two of them were. But, you know, we were also very alternative looking, and to see it, like, it was just odd to see two people like that busking. So we had these, we didn't even question it. Like, we thought that, like, yeah, we'll be getting a record deal now in about a year or so, you know. In my head, that's the way it was all kind of going anyway. Mm. And then real life kicks in, and you realise that, like, you know, you're travelling on a bus to work for like 4 and a tube. It's taking you like hours to get to work and hours to get home, and you're completely exhausted. And by the weekend, then you're, you know, you're in bed for most of the weekend, just delighted that you're not, you know, travelling or working.
Did you miss anything about Ireland when you were in London?
It was when I came back from London. I remember, like, when I decided this is it, I'm moving back to Ireland. You know what I mean? I don't want to live here anymore. It was a recession in London. I was living in Shepherd's Bush Road, which was brilliant because I met Rick Mail, and, you know, I used to see all the BBC stars, met Jason Donovan, and that was lovely, you know, that I was living there during that time. But I remember coming back to Ireland and opening my window and actually breathing in fresh air, having lived in the middle of, like, you know, in central London. And when I came back, I actually realised how beautiful Ireland was, because I'd never explored Ireland previous to leaving Ireland.
When did you come out?
I came out twice. I came out when I was 15 and I jumped back in because no one wanted to shag me, and there wasn't any people admitting they were gay in Ireland. There was a few close friends that I had that we all knew were gay, but we never, like, you know, we never had sex or anything with anyone. I had like a few little flirty things, you know, when I was out in clubs and things like that, but never ever. So, and at that stage, you know, I was only 15 and I did find girls attractive, and I was having, you know, I did have quite a few girlfriends as well, you know, so. And then the second time I came out, I was 25 actually. I was 25 and I was at a party in my flat in town in Limerick. This guy, he was a friend. He was more like my friend's friend, you know. I didn't really know him. Again, we were at a party, we were talking, and, you know, we were both out of our faces. And he said, oh, he said, do you want to go downstairs for a chat? And I knew exactly what he meant. So we went downstairs, but basically there's this big, huge closet underneath the staircase. And we went in there and he was giving me a blowjob. And then all my friends we could hear my friends looking for me basically upstairs going, where's Jerry? Where's Jerry? And then one of my friends, Larkin, goes, I know where he is, and ran down the stairs and opened the door of the closet while I was getting a blowjob, and ran back up the stairs laughing. So I basically had to come out of a closet and walk back up the stairs and just kind of go, yeah, okay, guys, you know, I'm gay. That was it. So I literally came out of a closet. There are a few people that have had profound effects on my life. Obviously my mother, because I knew that I always knew that I was really loved. I knew I was loved dearly, and that mattered. And I clung to that, really, really clung to that, because I didn't feel a lot of love from a lot of places when I was a child. But when that had a really profound effect on my life, other people in my life would have been, and now some of these people would be surprised to hear this, but Charlotte Nolan, my best friend's sister, she was so intelligent, and she was so, her taste in music was brilliant. She used to teach me words like opulent, you know, I knew what the word opulent meant when I was like 11 and stuff. And you know, I love being educated. I love learning. If anyone can teach me anything, I am just an open book right all over me. You know what I mean? I am empty pages waiting to be filled. Charlotte Nolan had such a massive effect on me as a child. Not only because she educated me and a lot of stuff that I wouldn't have learned anywhere else, like music, and just she was so descriptive, and so she was actually so opulent in like her descriptions of stuff. And do you know, she was just an amazing woman to be with. And she would have been like 18 and I would have been probably 12, you know, and we used to kind of pal around with each other. And obviously Richard Nolan, because when I was a kid, I never felt the same as anyone else. And I always remember the first time I saw Richard Nolan. They had come, the Nolans had come home from America, and I saw Richard Nolan coming up around the corner of our estate, and he had a combat jacket on and long hair. This was 1978. You know, we were all like little kids, and he came up around the corner. He was only 2 years older than me, so he was only about 10. And he had like long hair and a combat jacket on and kind of a loose pair of jeans and stuff. And I remember looking at him and thinking, how odd, I want to be his friend. And I just went over and said, hey, will you play at me? And we were best friends ever since, still are. Richard Nolan showed me that him coming from America, it was very exotic to me, you know. It was something like, it was like, this was almost like an alien to me, you know. And it was exciting because I always wanted something different. I always wanted something that I didn't have. I didn't know what it was, but I knew that I wanted it. And he got me into David Bowie at the age of 9, you know. And that's something that, like, immediately my expectations of music and art and life from then on in were a lot higher than, you know, my normal age group. I kind of considered people my own age children. You know, I looked at them as kids, which was really odd. Then there was Jacqueline Johnson. Jackie Johnson was the coolest thing on 2 feet. I remember she came home from London. She was into Michael Jackson. She was, you know, she used to wear like, she used to have a raccoon belt. She used to have a raccoon tail on her belt. And she had like baggy pants. And I think she had like one of those little trilby hats. But I remember her coming home from London and she looked really alternative and cool. And I just remember looking at her and going, wow, that's really, you know, that's who I kind of want to be. That's the kind of person I want to be when I was a kid. And she was always really lovely as well. She was always really lovely to me when I was a child. She gave me my first Grace Jones tape. I mean, you know, someone who gives you a Grace Jones tape. I was like 13 at the time and she gave me a Grace Jones tape. And like, I know those things are probably not what would influence other people, but for me, they had such a those people had such a profound effect because they actually showed me who I was as a person. Because I didn't feel, no, like I said earlier, I didn't really feel like, it felt like I was holding back all the time until I got to my teens and until I met people like Charlotte Nolan, Richard Nolan, and you know, had witnessed people like Jackie Johnson, you know. And then that was kind of like me kind of coming out of myself, whereas other kids had been kind of justified. I never felt justified, you know, in the things I wanted to do or the things I wanted to talk about, or, you know, does that make sense?
Yeah. Is there, like, what's your proudest moment in life?
Oh, my proudest moment in life. Oh my God, I don't, because I'll start crying if I think about it. My proudest moment in life was, no, it's not big, but to me it was, I've had more, you know, people would look at me and go, God, you've had so many more better moments or moments that you should be prouder. But I remember myself and my friend Craig and a few of us, we did this community arts project where we went into schools and we taught children, you know, we did murals with them or we read them books and this, that and the other. And one day all of the schools were in a lina, they call it here, like just all the schools were lined up to go into their classes. And I was walking across the yard and they all started chanting my name as I was walking across the yard. And I remember just being, it took me completely unawares. I didn't know that they, I was just like kind of like a student teacher, really. Do you know what I mean? We were like student teachers, really, but like not even of that status, like, because we were just shown, you know, painting murals with them and teaching them little bits of art. But, you know, we'd have a great time with them, and Craig would always have a great time with them as well. But I remember walking across the yard and they're all going, Gerard, Gerard, Gerard. And I was going, like, it actually gave me a lump in my throat. I was so proud of that, that I had that effect on those people. And completely, I wasn't aware of it, obviously, but I didn't set out to do it. You know, I didn't set out for that. It just happened naturally. I would never seek approval from anybody else. I never would. Anyone will tell you that. I like it like everybody else. But, you know, if I feel something, if I have to say something, God knows I'm the first person to say it. You know, I'm always, my mouth's always getting me into trouble. But I don't mind that because it's what I feel. And I'd rather people know who I am and steer clear than, you know, hang around me and, you know, then find themselves, you know, in some way offended. But with just that moment was amazing. I just remember kind of going, it was almost like kind of validation. I kind of felt like, you know, I felt like, God, I am a good person. You know, the fact that I got married, I think the fact that me and my husband got married when, like, marriage wasn't legalized, and we were married by my best friend from when I was a teenager, Hazel. I think that was a brilliant and a really proud moment of my life as well. Because it was so great to stand in front of, like, all of my friends, all of my family, and, you know, be with a man who I loved and that I knew loved me as well. Getting married was, you know, an amazing thing to do. But to be married as two men and just go, fuck that, I don't care what religion or what government, or no one's going to tell me who I'm going to be with for the rest of my life. But have I regrets? Oh my God, I'm 45 years of age. I have so many regrets. Really, I have so... I regret not sticking with music because I know something would have came of it, but I just couldn't be around musicians and bands. They were just... ugh. They were... Everything was a competition. Everything was jealous. And it sucked the joy out of making music for me, you know. I've got some really good friends that are musicians, you know, and doing really well. And it's... and I love to see it. I love to see them doing well. But I always wished that I had just stuck with it. But you know, it's not too late. It's not too late. I'm going to record an album. The only thing is that I didn't record it when I was young and beautiful, because I definitely would have been much easier on the eye than I would now. What I regret not being who I was. I regret not saying all those things that were on my mind as a child. You know, I said a lot. Believe me, I spoke out. I was very individual. I was very clear on what I thought. A lot of things. But you know those little things, those little secrets that you have as a child and stuff. I regret not having said those earlier. You know, because I think I would have been a lot happier as a child. Because my mind was like a maze. I used to tie my brain up in knots at night in bed, like trying to sleep and stuff. And, you know, I'd come to my own little philosophies about stuff, and I'd come to my own, you know, my own reasons to why things worked. I was in my head too much as a child. I regret that. I don't want that much out of life, really, anymore. I discovered that the only thing you should ever really want to be in your life is happy. Because I watch these people and they're breaking their necks to try and be someone they're not, or they're breaking their necks trying to, you know, get that bit of attention. And, you know, and like, attention is something that always came to me quite easily, you know, without wanting it as well, you know, unwanted attention I've gotten as well. You know, but I watch these people, these fake people, and these poor people that, you know, feel that they have to be justified in some way by, you know, garnering attention. And, you know, and a bit, there's a little bit of it, I think, in everybody. You know, I had it when I was a kid. But I just realised, you know, I nearly died 3 times in my life. And the last time I nearly died was really severe. I was in Paris, and I basically drank some sort of caustic solution, and I was in Paris for 2 days, and it had burnt the esophagus out of me. And I had basically a doctor stand over my bed, tell me, oh, it could be 50-50 whether you live or die. And in that moment, it became very clear to me what was important in my life.
Ireland's just legalised marriage equality at the weekend. What's your view? Have you any views on it?
Have I any views on marriage equality? Yeah. I think this is the first time in my life that I have honestly felt 100% proud to be Irish. When the referendum passed, it was the first time in my life that I felt I am honestly 100% proud to be Irish. Because growing up, we were subject to the Catholic religion unbelievably, you know, in the 70s and the 80s growing up. It was like they had the last say on fucking everything, on your education, on, you know, on your community, on what we learned and how we were educated. It was always, the buck stopped with the Catholic religion, you know. When the marriage referendum was passed, I can honestly say I nearly, like everybody that was gay or, you know, bisexual or transgender, and I honestly felt a lump in my throat about 4 or 5 times during the day. I was just so happy to see that everybody got together and made such a massive change to the future. And it was the people of Ireland that did it, you know. It wasn't a legislator, or it wasn't, you know, somebody making a decision for it. It was left up to us. It was a brilliant, brilliant thing to do. And it just goes to show you, you know, like, if people do get together, like, people power is an unbelievable thing. It really is. Like, when people get together and put their minds to stuff, what they can do is amazing.
Many thanks to Ger for sharing his story. The innocence of childhood is something that we should cherish. In the Irish Constitution, we state we should cherish the children. And I really hope that as a people, we continue to ensure that all the children are cherished. You can join the conversation over on Facebook, facebook.com/MichaelMeets. For those of you who tweet, I'm at Michael_Conlon, or the podcast at MichaelMeets. Do you know someone I should meet? If so, drop me an email, hello@MichaelMeets.com. I really hope you enjoyed Ger's personal story as much as I did recording it, and many thanks for your continued support.